Hey all, welcome back to the Real Life Pharmacology Podcast. I'm your host, pharmacist Eric Christensen. Thank you so much for listening today. As always, head on over to reallifepharmacology.com, get your free 31-page PDF. Simply an email will get you access to that. It's on the top 200 drugs. Great study guide if you're going through pharmacology classes, looking for a refresher, or potentially taking board exams in the future as well. So again, reallifepharmacology.com. Simply an email will get you access to that free resource. All right, the drug of the day today is minocycline. Brand name of this medication is Minocin. Mechanistically, and from a category standpoint, I guess, this drug is an antibiotic, and it is a tetracycline derivative, as you could anticipate with the ending of the name. Mechanistically, how do tetracyclines work? They, from a broad perspective, they block bacterial protein synthesis. They do this by binding to the 30S and potentially to some extent the 50S ribosomal subunits to prevent that bacterial protein synthesis. Definitely a question I've seen come up on board exams and pharmacology exams throughout my career, for sure. So knowing that it's a tetracycline derivative, going to be in the same category as doxycycline, tetracycline. Usual dosing is similar to doxycycline, in that is twice daily, 50 to 100 milligrams twice daily in most situations. Now, uses. The tetracyclines in general are a pretty broad spectrum antibiotic, and we do have IV and oral drug formulations. So skin and soft tissue infections, and it even has coverage for community-acquired MRSA. Acne, this is probably where I see it used most often on a chronic basis, kind of preventing and reducing the severity of acne. Again, that's usually not a first-line agent by any means to use a systemic antibiotic first-line for acne, but I definitely have seen dermatologists use it periodically in patients with severe cases who haven't responded to other topical therapy. Other activity against certain bugs, and from a historical standpoint, we've got a lot of good activity against kind of notorious bacteria, cholera, leprosy, plague, anthrax, unique bugs such as rickettsia, chlamydia, syphilis. So this drug definitely has some good coverage, but you see most often in clinical practice its brother or cousin used in doxycycline for treating some of these infections there. All right, administration from an oral perspective, I think, is important to note. Definitely recommended to take this with at least a significant amount of water. You know, I would say 4 to 8 ounces is reasonable. It can, if patients don't have adequate fluid intake, it can potentially stick a little bit to the esophagus, and in rare cases has caused ulceration, but certainly can cause irritation. So again, that's definitely a patient education point. Something I like to mention to patients is to take it with at least a significant amount of water, maybe 4 to 8 ounces at least. It can be given with or without food, depending upon you know, tolerability, GI upset, that type of thing. All right, adverse drug reactions. So the one that I have definitely seen come up on pharmacology exams throughout my career are using this medication in younger kids. We've got the potential to cause discoloration of the teeth. And that's historically been associated with all drugs within this class. Now, the best evidence and risk for that discoloration of the teeth, as well as alteration of bone growth suppression in really young kids, most of that data is associated with tetracycline in general, but it kind of gets relayed to all the agents, because oftentimes we do have alternatives that we can use in pediatric patients. So definitely a test question I've seen, and something to pay attention to there. So discoloration of the teeth, kind of this browning or yellowing of the teeth, can happen if we use it in younger developing patients. GI irritation, I kind of alluded to that, esophageal irritation with this medication. Other maybe less common things, so skin reactions, itching, dizziness. One important thing to note, depending upon time of year and where you live, is photosensitivity. So if you know patients are really active, they're outside a lot, they're getting a lot of sun, or you live in an area where there's tons of sun and the patients are outside frequently, photosensitivity and easily getting sunburn is an issue with minocycline for sure, and the tetracyclines in general. And then hyperpigmentation of the skin, that can happen as well. Kind of a little, probably less common thing than the photosensitivity, but something to pay attention to there. And then rare reactions that have shown up in the literature. There is potential for a lupus-like reaction. So if you remember hydralazine, I covered that medication. That's definitely one of the ones that pops up as probably the most common cause of a lupus-like reaction. But minocycline has been implicated in that as well. And then rarely, hepatotoxicity has been reported as well in the literature. All right, let's take a quick break from our sponsor, and we'll wrap up with drug interactions. If you're a pharmacist seeking board certification in ambulatory care, pharmacotherapy, geriatrics, MTM, or if you're a pharmacy student seeking certification for the NAPLEX, go check out meded101.com/store, STORE. We've got a great list of resources, helped literally thousands of customers over the years, and we continue to add and try to improve that each year with frequent updates. So go check that out. Support the sponsor, meded101.com/store. If you're a nurse, med student, PA student, I got lots of other resources as well. Nursing Guide, MedEd 101 Guide to Nursing Pharmacology is available on Amazon. Great resource for a lot of folks, very highly rated at this point. So we've certainly helped a ton of people with that. If you're looking for case studies, clinical pearls, drug interactions, we've got plenty of books on those things as well. Perils of Polypharmacy is a recent popular book I put together that demonstrates a lot of the issues with geriatrics and the challenge of trying to reduce medications and the challenges of adding medications, and where we might cause more harm than good in many cases. So lots of case studies, clinical pearls within that book on Amazon as well. All these links can be found at meded101.com/store. All right, wrapping up with drug interactions. Whenever I see a tetracycline antibiotic used, like minocycline, I always pay attention to binding interactions, and I often find issues. Okay, this is probably the one most important thing you can do if you're administering or educating patients about these medications. Pay attention to binding interactions. Okay, so which drugs bind to minocycline? Calcium. So there's tons of different calcium products. Many people take it for GI upset in a product like Tums. An overwhelming number of patients over the age of 60, 65 often supplement with calcium and vitamin D. And it may just be in a multivitamin as well. So you've got to pay attention to that. You've got to ask questions. Because if we give, let's say, calcium with minocycline, it's going to bind up minocycline, and it's not going to allow adequate absorption. So you're potentially going to lead to a situation of treatment failure if you're not getting adequate absorption. And it's not just calcium. There's a lot of like metal cations that can cause this issue. Zinc, magnesium, iron, And all these supplements can be not necessarily labeled as just zinc or just magnesium. They may be in combination in a multivitamin or other specialty products, and you've really got to go through the list and you've got to pay attention. And most often I'm finding I'm just recommending patients just hold that supplement as long as it's not ultra critical to what's going on. You can certainly just hold that supplement. So calcium supplement for osteoporosis, for example, if they've got, you know, 5, 7, 10 day course of minocycline, probably not a huge issue if they go without their calcium for a short period of time like that. If they feel like they absolutely need to take it, that type of thing, give minocycline 2 hours before or 4 to 6 hours after that supplement. That's going to cause that binding issue. I would also add sucralfate or carafate to that interaction binding list as well. Not used terribly often, but occasionally for people with GI issues, you might see that medication used. And then Pepto-Bismol, bismuth, can also bind up minocycline. All right, a couple other interactions that I think are somewhat relevant. So lithium, obviously a, you know, higher risk, higher reward medication in the management of bipolar disorder. Lithium concentrations can be potentially increased with the use of minocycline. So that's something to at least clinically monitor, asking the patients about, you know, increased risk for lithium toxicity, that type of thing. And obviously I've gone through lithium in the past, so definitely pull up that podcast if you aren't sure on lithium toxicity signs and symptoms. And then warfarin is another medication as well. I usually, just to be safe, generally tend to associate any antibiotic with interacting with warfarin and potentially increasing INR and increasing bleed risk. Now, there are exceptions to that, of course. Rifampin does the opposite, where it's an enzyme inducer and potentially reduces the effectiveness of warfarin, but many, many antibiotics have the potential to interact with warfarin and raise INR. So what do we often do in practice? We simply monitor the INR, check it, monitor for signs of bruising, bleeding, that type of thing when we're working with patients on that. All right, well, I think that's going to wrap up the podcast for today. Thank you so much for listening. If you have a spare moment, 3 seconds, 5 seconds, leave a quick rating or review on iTunes or whatever platform you're listening on there. That's greatly appreciated. It helps us grow the podcast. If you've got a little bit more time, 30 seconds to a minute, share the podcast. Email a friend, colleague, somebody who's preparing for a board exam or going through pharmacology classes or just needs some clinical updates and refreshers on medication safety and medication management. So please continue to help this podcast grow, and that's one way you can support it without supporting the sponsor, MedEd101.com, through financial contributions there. You can track me down, Eric Christensen, PharmD, BCPS, BCGP on LinkedIn. Otherwise, you can email me directly, mededucation101@gmail.com, and that is the best way to get a hold of me. I do my best to respond to every email I get for sure there. So again, mededucation101@gmail.com. With that, I'm going to sign off for today. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.